This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Mira Sivisodi. It's Dr. George in the house. Welcome, oh, consultant urologist. It is our Doctor in the House series. How are you today, George?
I'm very good. Yeah. You know, it's Friday. I'm obviously delighted to be here.
Very good. Today we're going to be discussing World Delirium Awareness Day. Did you? I mean, of course, you know what it is, but the first time I read it, I was a little confused. I didn't
realize. You're confused because you're delirious.
No, yeah. I wasn't sure.
That's a good one, right?
From my introduction, I didn't realize it came from the word delirious. Delirious, I knew. Delirium, I wasn't quite sure. But joining us today to help us understand what delirium really is Professor Dr. Tan Mopin, our consultant geriatrician from University of Malaya. How are you today, Dr. Tan?
I'm fine, thank you.
Wonderful.
Yeah, I always love to have you on the show. Always so bubbly.
And then he brought you chocolates and all that.
I know.
It's bribery. Yeah. So that she can be kind to me.
I'll try.
Don't fall for it. You've had something going on World Delirium Day. You want to tell us a little bit more about it? And, you know, you wrote to me and you said you wanted to bring about more awareness as far as this condition is concerned. What is it?
Do you know it affects 1 in 4 people over the age of 60 who are admitted to medical wards in the hospital?
Wow, that's a lot.
25%.
Yeah, that's kind of.
And then if you're over 80, it's actually around about 60%.
Where does that statistic come from?
We actually did it.
All right.
So we sent these unemployed medical graduates who comes to spend some time with us to get some medical.
You mean you abused the interns?
Pre-interns. Yes. So they went there and they just went and assessed every single older person who came into the medical ward within 48 hours of admission, and that was the figure they got. Okay. So we were not surprised, because actually that's quite similar to other international figures. So that means that we are getting there as a developed nation, but it also means that this is a very big problem that's not been addressed at all.
Yeah, and you're looking at people who are in admission at the hospital, but we don't know what's happening outside.
Well, we kind of have an idea what's happening outside. So basically, delirium is acute confusion. So the older person will be fine one day, and then suddenly the next day they're not behaving quite so well.
Not quite themselves.
Yes, not quite themselves. And it's horrifying what's been happening, because we sometimes get these people who actually then come in after being even admitted to a nursing home because the family can't cope looking after them, without realizing that actually acute confusion, and an acute confusion state, is actually a medical emergency. It's usually caused by a serious medical illness, and that's why they become very confused. Okay. So they actually need urgent medical attention.
Yeah, coming back to your statistics from the abuse of the pre-interns that you've done, checking. I'm saying it. Okay. 1 in 4. I mean, how did they make that diagnosis that the person's delirious? Because, you know, sometimes I wake up in the morning and I don't feel like I'm quite myself. And does that constitute delirium?
There are lots of causes of delirium, including...
What are the characteristics that you will go through to say, okay, this person is delirious?
Okay, so we actually have this method called the confusion assessment method that we taught to them.
Okay.
So they will go and see the patient and observe for patterns of fluctuating attention, as well as difficulty with paying attention to something, as well as disorganized thinking. Mm. So if they have any of those, then they could have delirium.
Mm.
So based on that, we've actually developed a much easier to use tool called the 4-point assessment test.
Mm.
And we've actually modified it a little bit. So we're calling it the MY480, Malaysian 4-point assessment test.
Wow.
And we actually asked them to actually name place, come up with a date of birth, as well as to count from backwards from 20 to 1. And if you can't do any of those, then your brain's not working right.
Mm.
So it's actually a screening test.
So essentially it's like mini mental state, kind of like...
But much shorter.
Much
so
shorter.
4 points.
All right, okay. So what sort of like place would you expect, over 65-year-old to name that you would think that they should know?
The hospital.
Yeah. The hospital, where they are.
And also where the date of birth is.
Okay. But, you know, what you said serious medical illnesses could trigger this, such as what? What sort of illness could trigger
delirium? It's almost anything.
Wow.
Well, in my line of work, it's always urinary tract infections.
Absolutely.
And,
that's right.
And, that can lead to delirium.
Yes, so it
that's
can.
That's commonest. One of the commonest, care of elderly ward asking us to go and attend to a patient who's a bit dullarly. Okay, I'm sorry. Delirious.
He's so wrong and on so many levels.
All right, I'm sorry.
I apologize, Dr. Tan.
But actually, it is quite humorous to us as well, because the older person does do lots of things that they wouldn't normally do. And sometimes they become overexcited, they won't stop talking. But the ones who we really worry about are the ones who just lie there and who are just not doing anything. So it's hypo and hyperactive delirium.
Right. So it's either they are completely almost catatonic and don't do anything.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Or they are just kind of like start mopping the floor and then start cleaning the windows.
Well, we've never quite had that. Right. But, we have had, old men romping around,
naked.
Hitting people and everything. Yes.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Sometimes they do that. It's a lot on when they get urinary tract infection, because they try to urinate and then somehow they just get naked and start, romping around, like
but,
you said.
But why do they react like that? And is it a temporary state of confusion?
Well, there's still so much work that needs to be done, actually, in delirium itself. Because when these people are confused, we can't actually, at the moment, the ethical framework for research doesn't allow us to do research with them, because they need to give consent, but they they have no ability to give consent because they have some mental disturbance. So we actually have to look at our ethical frameworks to allow us not to discriminate against delirious people by not including them in research studies.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. That's a challenge, isn't it?
Oh, it's a huge challenge. I have not succeeded yet.
So what you're implying is that we actually don't know the link between illnesses such as urinary tract infection, pneumonia, or even skin infections, hepatitis, something that lead to this state of confusion.
Well, the hypothesis is that because anybody can become delirious, so even a young person at the peak of their fitness, where if they have a serious enough illness, they can become delirious.
Oh.
So our presumption is that with older people, it's just that the brain vulnerability is so great that even a milder illness can then make the brain go out of kelter.
So what's happening in the brain?
Well, we think it's disturbance in the chemicals, obviously, when you have an infection, you throw off lots of toxins, etc. So, and those toxins can then affect the chemical processes that occurs. But as I said, it's very difficult to do research on them because, first of all, they won't cooperate. Mm-hmm. But also, our ethical framework won't allow us to even touch them because we need consent to do it.
Yeah. I mean, we're going back to medical school days and, clearly we're from the same medical schools. And then we're always taught to check their electrolytes, right?
Yes.
Their salt balances. I mean, can you just explain a little bit about what happened with these, chemicals and electrolytes whenever, by rectifying them or normalizing them, are we getting them back to their normal state of mental capabilities?
Yes. Well, the brain actually works a lot on chemicals. We need chemicals to carry messages around the brain. So chemicals like salt, sodium, or calcium, potassium, all that can be deranged when someone's got delirium. So typically, even a simple thing like a blood pressure tablet sometimes can make our kidney get rid of too much salt in our body. So the low salt level can then make the older person delirious. So the treatment's very easy. You just stop the diuretic that they're taking that to lower their blood pressure, and then the sodium's restored and they will be back to normal.
So low levels of sodium.
Yeah. That's quite common, isn't it? Let's say a doctor, a GP, unintentionally prescribe something but not monitoring it carefully, and it'll result in delirium. Because in my line of work, as you know, that we try to stop men from going to toilet so often at night, we give them this medication called desmopressin.
Yes.
And essentially, we just kind of like make them hold on to as much water as possible, not producing the urine at night. When you hold on to it, you dilute your salt, and then that's when they end up in hospital with
delirium.
Dr. Tan kind of calling me up and say, did you check his sodium?
No, they're a bit callous, these urologists, sometimes.
Sometimes.
So my question is, do medical staff sort of miss this condition?
Good question.
All the time. In fact, everyone's so focused at the moment on just treating illnesses without treating the whole patient.
Mm.
So our main burden at the moment is, if you take an older person into hospital at the A&E, because they all look sick, they all look really sick, they will actually put a tube in their a cannula in their arm. They will put a tube in their bladder. They will give them oxygen through more tubing. Sometimes they also put a tube into their nose. And all these, we call it invasive procedures. Mm-hmm. I mean, to the doctor, it's every run-of-the-mill stuff. But to the older person, it's very frightening.
Because technically, we're treating the pathology. And then that whole person who is not quite himself or herself, actually, we miss, which is quite ironic, isn't it?
Yes, I know. Because we don't know what's wrong with them. So they just treat them for everything. Yeah. But by doing that, they actually precipitate the delirium. So even if they come in without the delirium, we actually make the delirium happen by doing all sorts of weird things, because they'll be thinking, oh no, I'm in a sci-fi movie and all
anxiety.
The people are attacking me, you know.
Interestingly, you mentioned these interventions actually where it may worsen that delirious state, but the sole reason of being in an unfamiliar environment like a hospital can trigger that, wouldn't it be the case?
Yes. It's the same thing, because they don't understand what's going on. And already the brain processes is slowed down, because they have to, I suppose the body has to conserve the energy to fight the infection. So it's not giving enough energy to the brain to actually process properly.
And is it a temporary state?
Yes. That's a beauty about delirium. It's reversible, and it's very reversible. So we say you have to remove the offending agent or the offending cause or causes, and over time things will get better.
Why do you think awareness is needed in this? I mean, to me, it's not
to
a major problem.
Of a day, right?
Yeah, that you know you have a delirium awareness day when it's something that can be easily treated, and it's only temporary, because you know we have big things like World Alzheimer's Day and World Heart Day and World Diabetes. All of that we know is life threatening. Whereas delirium
is life threatening.
It is.
Yes.
Okay. So we'll come back. Yeah, we'll come back and find out more how delirium, you know, to me it sounds pretty simple, but how it can be life threatening. Coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. It's our Health and Living segment. Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist in the studio with us. It's our Doctor in the House series. Professor Dr. Tan Mo Pin, consultant geriatrician from University of Malaya, joining us. We're discussing World Delirium Awareness Day. If you're wondering what it is a state, acute state of confusion, which often affects the elderly, as Dr. Tan has alluded to, based on studies. About 25% of those elderly in admission are prone to delirium. Do they all experience delirium, the 25% that you sort of studied?
Yes, and it's undetected. So we don't screen for it routinely. I always ask my students, you examine everybody's heart, don't you? How often do you hear a murmur? Why don't you test everybody's memory? But that's just not in our medical curriculum. Because when the medical curriculum was set in stone many centuries ago, we didn't have old people on this earth, but now we just have so many of them. But our whole medical training is not geared towards it.
So you can actually screen somebody for delirium?
Yes.
Because in my mind, you will only know when it happens.
Yes.
So how do you screen for it?
So we can look at people, we can identify people who are particularly at risk of delirium. So we know that people who are older, people who already have pre-existing dementia, who have, we call it sensory deprivation, so problem with their vision, problem with their hearing, and also people with ongoing multiple medical problems, they are particularly at risk of delirium. So if we identify those who are at risk of delirium, we need to be able to observe them closely, make sure that we orientate them properly, make sure we don't put in tubes that they don't need, and then we treat things judiciously and also promptly, then hopefully we can actually prevent it coming, or we lessen, even if it does come along, it won't be as bad as if we hadn't watched out for
it. Okay, so what are the effects if you do have an episode of delirium?
Well, we know that anyone who has delirium is at increased risk of death. And actually the mortality from delirium is pretty high.
How?
Because it's a sign of serious illness. So it's actually a complication of
illness. Is it the chicken or egg situation? Is the delirium leading to death, or the underlying medical illness that actually is leading to death?
It's probably a bit of both.
Okay.
But even when you adjust for the severity of illness, if you get delirium, you're still more likely to die, because you just take longer to recover. You're not going to cooperate with treatment, for starters. So I'm sure you've been to hospital wards where the older person is pulling out everything.
Yeah.
So you can't do anything with them.
How long will an episode last?
Yeah.
It varies. So for some people, it's short. So even if they get delirium, we actually aim to shorten it by actually doing all the stuff like reality orientation, make sure they're well hydrated, correct anything we can correct, but also doing it judiciously without being too invasive. Then they can shorten their delirium, and that's actually reduce the risk of death. Generally, we can't even diagnose dementia if someone comes in with acute confusion and we suspect they probably have dementia underlying. We can't adjust it. We can't even diagnose it until we've waited 6 months. So it can last. Yeah,
this is the part
months.
Where I want to chip in. And was like, I'm a mere urologist. And obviously, all these terminology, you know, if it confuses me, I'm sure it's confusing the Klang Valley listeners. So, obviously, the purpose of awareness is that we can make the correct diagnosis and aware of such medical condition. How do you differentiate between delirium with dementia, hallucination, psychosis, and confusion? I mean, is it just a spectrum? Is it reversibility, or is it just describing completely different things?
You just mess with my brain, John.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, confusion is just not thinking straight, so it can be dementia or delirium.
Okay, can be both.
Yeah, and actually, it's an important thing to know what's the difference between dementia and delirium. Dementia comes on very slowly. You have to have at least 2 years' history of gradual progressive loss of memory before we can be confident you've got dementia. Delirium comes on suddenly, so that's what we want people to know, that if someone suddenly becomes confused, they could have some serious medical problem. They could be having a heart attack, or they could have a pneumonia. And unless you bring them into medical attention as soon as possible, they could actually succumb to that illness.
Right. Okay.
So what you're saying, one is chronic, one is acute, one has potential underlying serious medical condition, the other one is ongoing, not quite reversible.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
And so it's a medical emergency.
Yes, it is a medical emergency.
If something like that happens at home, what do you do?
We would actually say bring them to hospital. Yeah, I know most people don't want to. But even if you go to a regular GP, they will still want you to send them to hospital because it's a medical emergency. Yeah, and it's even worse if the GP does not recognise that this is delirium. Then you end up delaying treatment and it's just going to get worse. Mm-hmm.
So the wait-and-see approach will not probably work.
And we are quite, we need to be quite quick with actually investigating because the patient can't tell you what's wrong with them.
Well, I mean, can delirium in a more extreme spectrum be defined as like almost like psychosis or...?
They can actually have hallucinations, but the hallucinations usually, because they can't think straight, so hallucinations usually not very organized, it's not very complicated hallucinations,
right.
But it can make them very distressed.
So if they, let's say a delirious person who find themselves not remembering where they are, not really knowing the date, things like it's 1957, and suddenly seeing Elvis, and then hallucinating.
Won't be as complicated as seeing Elvis, because it'll just be maybe some little people around and that's it.
Okay.
Yeah, so, or some shadows, etc., and they get very frightened.
Okay, get very frightened and that sort of thing. I mean, is that psychosis in some way or not?
Well,
quite?
It's a little bit psychosis, and in fact, one of the ways that we found quite effective to treat this is to actually use bright light therapy, so they don't see the shadows, they're not so frightened, and they recover faster. So the lighting's very important.
How do we keep the patient safe at home if an episode like this happens?
Well, usually, if they're very disturbed, they need to be in an environment where people know how to handle them, actually. And we don't want a very acutely delirious patient to be actually sent home. They need to be somewhere where they have appropriate medical care. So, but if they're recovering and the family knows how to look after them, then we will teach them. We will actually teach them how to manage. So you tend to, we call it de-escalate, but if they get really hyped up, we tend to de-escalate and we actually don't challenge them, change the subject, and also prevention is very important. So sometimes we know exactly what time, when they're going to go off. So we call it sundowning. So we actually say to the family, you might want to take them out for a walk, get some sunshine, fresh air, kind of early afternoonish, so that by evening time they would be calmer.
Are you suggesting that this is quite recurring? Like, you know, like once you've been admitted once.
Once you've had a delirium, you're far more likely to have a delirium
on a repeated basis. So it's actually quite scary for the family member to say.
And they actually get used to it after a while. So they can kind of identify the early signs and they'll say, oh, I think mum's getting another UTI.
All right.
That kind of thing.
All
yes.
Right. All okay. Right. Okay. Oh, see, now we know that, you know.
So it's a symptom in a way.
Yeah. It's this kind of presenting manner rather than.
We sometimes, you know, because it's so recurrent, we actually sometimes gift the family a little stock of antibiotics.
Okay.
As soon as you see the signs.
Oh, so you're the one who get all the resistance set off.
Well, actually, that's one thing that drives me rather crazy is because we say that a lot, UTI does cause you delirium. It's so easy for the doctors to then treat every single delirium like a UTI and not actually look for a proper cause. Mm. And that's also quite dangerous.
It is.
Like heart disease, as you mentioned. Yeah. You said there's a hyperactive and hypoactive sort of delirium. So in some cases, they become very hyped up.
Yes.
Which one is more dangerous?
It's actually the hypo, because
when they go all quiet.
Yeah,
I would imagine that hyper, they would just fall off the beds or, you know, and get themselves hurt. Hypo, they just sit there, right? Harmless.
Well, that's even worse, isn't it? Because nobody knows that they have delirium. Because a hypo one is very easy to spot, isn't it?
All right.
Yeah, it doesn't take a genius to know that they're confused.
Okay.
Whereas the hypo one's just so quiet, so that you don't actually know that they have delirium, but they're not participating, they're not really eating properly.
Yeah. Interesting you mentioned that the hypo are the one we potentially miss, because you just think the old lady just wants a bit of quiet moment and then you just leave her alone, but before you know it, the pneumonia or urinary tract infection is brewing.
That's right.
How many of those 1 in 4 hospital admissions that you detected have delirium that you actually find the underlying cause? Because I would imagine a lot of them were so transient that the underlying serious medical etiology was never identified.
We usually find a reason if we look hard enough.
Okay.
Rarely we'll say, oh, I suppose it's come and gone and we've missed it.
Yeah.
But usually you can find something.
Yeah.
And inexperienced doctors tend to focus right down to the infection.
Okay.
But you need to look, you know. Sometimes it's gout.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you just need to draw back the covers and you go, oh, look at that big toe.
Okay.
It's looking a little bit red and swollen.
Okay.
Yes. And or you do look at the heart trace, or you make them do a heart trace, because sometimes they forget.
Okay.
And then you realize, oh, actually, they've had a small heart attack.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. When I'm old, will you look after me?
Oh,
Dr. Tan, really?
I
mean, like,
No, I want you to look after me. That's quite soon. Okay,
we promise to be in the same ward, so it'll be a lot easier for you.
We'll be going carnage in there. I'm going to ask you some questions. This is a bit naughty. I'm going to ask you some questions. Obviously, in the Asian setting, and then, you know, with all these superstitions and people worry about, I'm sure you come across, you know, people would just say, you know, this is, you know, stepping on dirty stuff.
Possessed.
You know, like religious, possessed.
And that's often why they don't come into medical
attention. It's because, they just kind of say, because, you know, my mum first thing will ask, you know, if granny is ill, and it was the first thing would just go to Beaumont. And instead I said, look, you know, it's just because of, you know, stepping on wrong things or seeing ghosts or that sort of thing. I'm sure you come across that.
Yes, definitely.
So obviously, you know, as a scientific person, and then we also don't want to be dismissive to a member of family that, you know, look, it's not always this, you know. And how do you handle a situation like that?
We will just explain to them that they've got a medical problem that's actually made their brain not think straight.
Mm.
Usually the ones who go to the BOMO never ends up with us. So
right.
We wouldn't actually know how many actually lost their lives because it was missed, etc. So, but yes, sometimes they are very frightened. They say, why are they doing this? And sometimes they actually think they do it intentionally.
Yeah.
And
because early on when you say 1 in 4, I would think that, you know, maybe 1 in 4 that's presented to you, another, you know, 5 or 6 actually, you know, is being taken care by some sensei somewhere or bomb or somewhere, and
that
will lead to serious medical consequences.
Well, potentially, especially the hypoactive ones.
Right.
You know, the family will just go, lying there, not doing anything.
Possessed by something.
Yes.
So your 1 in 4 is actually an underestimated number, you think? Do you think the numbers are more?
Potentially, yeah. But until we have better tools and also we screen a lot more, then maybe we can actually pick up more.
Is delirium a precursor for dementia?
We think it is.
Mm.
So it's almost how much reserve you have in your brain. So if you have reduced brain reserve, then when you're ill, then it manifests as acute confusion. So at some point, your brain reserve will go down enough for you to actually have permanent mental confusion.
That's a good way of looking at it. It's just like kind of like a, you know, you have your quota and then now it's running short. And then so any trigger will just set us off and it's probably giving you some sign that your tank is running a bit low. Right.
But yeah. I'm just thinking if it can be so many other conditions as well, how are you going to say it's a precursor to dementia for this one particular patient? Gout is obvious, heart disease. So you're going to go through the whole list of possible medical conditions?
Well, and basically they have a medical condition, because it can be any medical condition. So when that flares up, then because they don't have enough brain reserve, so because when you are ill, then you're having to tap into your reserves to fight the infection.
Yep.
So when you have not enough brain reserves, then your brain just stop working properly. So it can be any condition. And sometimes it occurs in combination. And that's what makes geriatrics so fascinating. And that's why we think we're special, because, you know, we are willing to actually go through all the conditions and decide how to treat them, etc. So we don't always win the battle, but at least, you know, we have a decent go at it. And you know, the primary interest is to actually ensure that the patient's not suffering. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Does it accelerate the progression of dementia?
Yes. So,
doomed, lad, George.
That's right.
So, when the cognitive function goes down, memory, when the ability of the brain goes down with an infection, it doesn't always quite go back up to what it was. So, it's more like a kind of seesaw, but then the baseline keeps going down. So we do have people who then develop dementia after several episodes of delirium.
Delirium, okay. Yes. So there's no treatment and it cannot be prevented?
Well, the treatment is very obvious. You treat the cause. Yeah, you treat the cause.
So you have to find the cause. So effectively, identify, make the diagnosis, and then look for the cause. And then once the cause is reversed, then the delirium will disappear.
Yes, because delirium is not a disease. It's a symptom that's totally unrecognized.
You know, I'm just thinking of our healthcare system at the moment and how we all go to specialists for, you know, various conditions.
Yes.
We, you know, the GPs are, you know, the last resort. Nobody really thinks about the GP most of the time unless it's the cough and the flu, right?
Yes.
So then chances are this is going to be missed.
Yes. So I think we need to work closely with the GP. I just found myself writing a really long letter to a health clinic Sehatan doctor yesterday to explain to them that, you know, this auntie actually lives very near their clinic. For them to come to hospital is a very long way. Is it okay if we embark on joint care? And, you know, then I start explaining, okay, blood pressure treatment, not too aggressive. This is the target. Blood sugar treatment, not too aggressive. This is the target. Anything, you send me an email. I hope that we can do more of that. But I'm not sure that they're going to respond at this moment because they're not used to the idea of working conjointly. Yes, and especially in the private sector.
Yeah. Yes. You know, yes, so you have the private sector and then you have the government
yes.
sector.
Yes.
I like Mira raising this, scenario of the family doctor being redundant in many aspects, because they are really, really the person who looks at the patient in totality.
Yes.
Because you're right, going to see a specialist, we look at a part of your functional organ or a pathology rather than looking at you in totality.
Yeah, I mean, I think we could do better with our primary healthcare system.
Mm. I think if we could get a more active primary healthcare system, a lot of the delirium could potentially be prevented. So, for instance, if they can actually go into to the older person's house, because they have to come to hospital because the older person's too ill to go and sit for hours in a GP practice.
Mm-hmm.
But if the GP is able to go to the older person's house and administer treatment there, then they haven't got to come to a strange environment where they have lots of tubes stuck into them, and we might have prevented the episode of delirium altogether.
I'm just very curious. I'm going to throw something at the both of you. You know, we have certain apps in this country where you can actually call for a doctor.
Yes.
Uber doctor.
Within a certain radius. It almost works like the ride-sharing model. What are your thoughts on that when it comes to the older person? Do you think something like that might work? I mean, these are qualified doctors, GPs, you know, recognized by the MMA and MMC and all of that. But what are your thoughts on that?
We actually want that to happen. So we're actually developing an app with the computer science department. So at the moment, we're doing home-based monitoring. They're working with the primary care doctors to actually monitor their blood pressure, blood sugars, etc. But I would, and then we're moving on to actually getting them to put in instruments to assess memory, physical strength, as well as falls risk. And after that, we would like a button where they can just call a doctor, and then the doctor can then send us some of this information. It can decide whether they can manage it or they need to co-manage it, and they can maybe send some of that information into tertiary care, and then we can actually give them some advice, and that will really reduce the load of hospitals, because at the moment it's not like we're short of business. We're always full and we're always shut. So it's about time we do something to actually reduce the burden of tertiary care.
Isn't there room for abuse in a system like that?
Well,
and what about what about medical errors? Who would be responsible?
Well, that's the problem, because there's always all these barriers. Our legal infrastructure is not built up for things like that, and everybody always has a million reasons why not, you know. But all I can see is you just have to build the infrastructure and the legal legislation and the regulations around this. Otherwise, we have really no solution.
You just described something like almost like an app that actually feeds all your parameters into it, and eventually someone somewhere, a doctor, will analyze it and will come back to you if there's a problem, right?
Yes.
Don't you think eventually that will make doctor redundant, because a computer will read all those a lot faster? It's artificial intelligence.
No, don't be concerned, lad. They will still need you to read it.
That's a primary concern. But there's one thing that I know they'll always need is a geriatrician. Because we don't just look at numbers.
All right.
Yes. Yeah, so have to look at the patient.
Well, but technically, you know, if you look at that sort of like looking at parameters, essentially it's predicting a pattern.
Yes.
So that pattern is sending out alarm, then alarm will trigger a response.
Yeah, but it's only a pattern.
Yeah.
Right? So if you fall out of the pattern, then what happens?
Yeah, well, you fall
that's
out
where
pattern,
you will come into play, George.
No, I'm not worried about responding to your question about, you know, these kind of like doctors on demand that has been sent to you straight away. I mean, I think eventually, I like the idea that, you know, the patients can be treated at home, in a comfort of the home. And then, of course, the economy of scale and everything, that it will drive down the price, and then it's competitiveness and that sort of thing. But what I worry about is continuity of care, because currently we're lacking continuity of care. Because, you know, the auntie who has that delirium episode, it's a pattern that it's developing over a period of time. So for a GP who knows this auntie from day one, will pick that up straight away.
But GP will be inputting this information into common records.
No, I mean the old style going to family doctor, rather than the, you know, apps and that sort of
technology. But that's not happening already,
indeed, George. That's why in some way, you know, the healthcare that is serving the elderly populations, it's when you don't look at the patient in a holistic manner, which is exactly what you said, because you don't look at parameters, you look at the person in totality, and eventually it's just going to have a lot of deficiencies.
For sure, don't you think? But isn't that happening already now?
Yes, because like you said, you know, when elderly mummy is ill, and then the only thing the people will ring around and say, which doctor should I see? And then they'll say, oh, is it the leg pain? Then you see orthopedics, or is it, you know, frequent urination? You'll see urologists.
Yes.
Miss the whole picture.
I often spend an hour trying to figure out, trying to explain to the doctor, to the patient, what each of these doctors mean, and why is it that I don't agree with any of them.
That's
and
right.
it's crazy, because a patient doesn't need to see five doctors.
Yeah, five doctors with different drugs that are causing five different problems.
I think often we go and do that because we are waiting to hear what we want to hear.
Yes.
And until we get that,
yes,
we will continue to doctor shop. And then continue to get different, you know, advice.
Yes.
I mean, funny enough,
there needs to be some amount of trust.
You mentioned that, you know, in our hospital that I worked at, everything is arranged in pathology. You get chest physicians, you get cardiologists, you get urologists, yeah. you get neurologists. Everything is pathologists. The only person who is not really pathology-based is a geriatrician, a care yeah. elderly, because you look at the patient in totality.
Correct.
And the sad thing is that if you have anyone who's below 65 who don't qualify to be looked after by Dr. Tan, then you're a bit stuck because you cannot just ask for this holistic physicians who can actually, you know, look at the person in
well,
totality.
And there's so few of us, we can't possibly do what a general practitioner does for the older person either, because there's only 30 of us. We can't possibly be a GP to 100,000 person. It's yeah. not possible.
It's not feasible, yeah.
So 30 of you in the whole country.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, and there are 3 million older
just,
people.
Mira and I would just be
booking
two
you
customers.
Now. yeah? We're sending
we
in
a... We need to expand. That's right, yeah.
Yes, clone. Yeah. Okay, not quite clone.
Just,
So coming back to prevention, can we prevent delirium?
Definitely. I mean, the first thing to do is to make sure you have lots of what we call it cognitive reserve. That means your brain has lots of stores. So build it up from young.
So Sudokus.
No, education.
Education.
Oh my gosh.
Training just make your brain exercise more?
I'm sure you won't be very happy if I tell your child to go and do Sudoku. I'm sure you want
now,
to go to university.
Now, do it now so that you expand yes. your reserve so that you don't become too delirious in the future. So that's a wrong attitude, is that right?
But it could be UTI, George.
Yeah, UTI, that's right. So you might be pretty good in your Sudokus, yeah. and then, yeah, you start drawing on the wall when you get UTI.
Yeah.
You know,
or gout.
No, gout.
Yeah.
So build your cognitive reserve. And also when you actually fall ill, to actually not go to hospital unless you really have to. And for hospitals to be aware that, you know, there are risk factors, identify them early and treat. Don't put too many tubes in, make sure that they're nutritionally fine, make sure they've got their glasses, their hearing aids, make sure they eat properly, make sure that all the salts in their bodies are not helter-skelter. Yeah. A lot of times we give them the drip and then it makes the salts go yeah. out of kelter when they were fine before. So don't do those kind of things. We call them iatrogenesis, so yeah. things caused by doctors. So we can actually reduce all the harm that we could be doing to the patient, then we can actually prevent delirium.
I mean, from the sound of it, you're awareness day, you want the healthcare providers to be aware of a lot of things. You also want general publics to be aware of a lot of things.
Yes.
That's a tall order. It's like,
no, well, they just need to know that when older people go to hospital, people do lots of things to them.
Yeah. And we want the medical fraternity.
That's right. Yes.
Need to say to the doctor, you know, he's very old already. Can you stop doing all these things because he might develop delirium?
All right.
Yes. And then they go, maybe I should just look it up, because we do have the position statement published by the Malaysian Society of Geriatric Medicine. It's an A6 booklet. It's very, very easy to use. It's got lots of tables with risk factors, treatment guidelines and everything. And so they can download it off the internet, keep it on their phone, but if they want, it's always downloadable just to actually...
This is aiming at the healthcare providers.
Yes.
All right, so basically the Care for Elderly Society is...
Malaysian Society of Geriatric Medicine.
Okay, yes. And then essentially set up these position statement.
Yes, that's
wow,
right.
Wow, very cool.
Yeah. Yeah. What did you mean when you say cognitive reserve?
That means the brain is able to still function even though there's a very big external insult. So like if they have an infection, they have
regardless of gouts or not,
yes,
I am still
right. My brain is still
not
fine.
Quite
because I can spare I can spare some brain.
How do you do that?
And how do I know the reserve is growing?
Sorry, how do I know?
Well, you just keep your mind sharp so that, you know, because a lot of older people, once they retire, they're just going to sit at home and watch television all day. But, you know, we know that if you do that, then, you still have the same number of
neurons. Sudoku then.
Exercise. You can exercise.
Voluntary work.
Yeah. Learn a new language.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Learn
a
new skill.
Yeah.
I think don't stop learning.
I mean, what are you doing for the Awareness Day? Or what have you done so far?
We've done a little social media blast. So we've
I'm a bit dinosaur. I don't even know what that means.
Well, you know, it's the same way that most people get the news nowadays.
Okay.
We just kind of send WhatsApp a message as viral, put the message on Facebook and ask people to like our Facebook.
Yeah, I got the WhatsApp blast.
Oh, did you?
Hence the show today.
Okay. I don't even know what that means. I'll go and look it up. I'll go and ask my 16-year-old girl and then find out what it
is. Yeah, maybe she can help us with Instagram because we're not so good with Instagram.
You already know, I'm just getting, you know, closer to, you know, stepping into Dr. Tan's clinic, you know. So that's why I'm not aware of any of these social media.
We'll build that cognitive.
I'm still okay with Instagram, right?
Yeah. How difficult is that?
All right, and they'll take a picture and then they kind of like write something. Yeah, I know. So I could, yeah, so I got quite a few followers.
That ain't going to build your cognitive reserve, George.
Well, actually, one of the things is to stay connected. So I'm sure we haven't quite done a study yet, but I'm sure all the people who do a lot of blogging, Twitter.
That's different. Counting likes doesn't
it massages your ego.
Your cognitive blogging is good because you got to write.
Yes, that's right. And then they will actually, and staying connected as well, and feeling that they're still contributing.
So Dr. Tan will be at the Health and Living Live event on Saturday, the 7th of April at Connection at Nexus Bangsa South, which is happening from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. And she will be part of a panel discussion on aging. Joining her on stage will also be Dato' Mahadev Shankar, who will share his journey growing old. So you don't want to lose out. If you want to register, log on to bfm.my/health event and get your tickets, and we'll see you on the 7th. Of April. Would you have a message this World Awareness, Delirium Awareness Day?
Well, delirium is very common in older people, and if you have an older person with you who suddenly become acutely confused, they could have something seriously medically wrong with them. Please go and see a doctor and get it treated straight away.
Yeah, so it's just an acute state of confusion. Yes. The best to find. George, your message?
My message is, you're looking after me regardless.
Oh, wow. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you both very much for joining us today. Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist, and Professor Dr. Tan Maupin, consultant geriatrician from University of Malaya. We're discussing delirium today on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.